From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
President Trump in Brussels delivering a public shaming to the veteran leaders there about NATO funding.
But 23 of the 28 member nations are still not paying what they should be paying and what they are supposed to be paying for their defense.
Macron says he wanted to get across that he wouldn't be willing to make small concessions, even symbolic ones, and that this handshake would be the way to do that without over-publicizing things.
Two leaders with well-known differences, President Trump and Pope Francis, met longer than expected at the Vatican.
I think the relationship that the president has had with Merkel, he would describe as fairly unbelievable. They get along very well. He has a lot of respect for her. They continue to grow the bond that they had.
The use of the term back channel to describe what Jared Kushner reportedly proposed doing with the Russians. Is that accurate to you? Is that what it was, a back channel?
Yeah, that's Anderson Cooper. A lot of voices in the news this week. And we're going to start, though, with some of the news at the state capitol. We're joined today by Max Reese, who is a reporter on politics for NBC Connecticut. He's sitting in the vaunted Colin McEnroe chair today. Colin is away this week. Hey, Max, how you doing?
This is a very comfortable chair. Good morning.
It is. We don't want to make it too comfortable for you, of course, though. Keith Vanoff is here. He's our budget guru, our budget Obi-Wan Kenobi from the Connecticut Mirror. Hi there, Keith.
Good morning.
And Daniela Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Hi, Daniela.
Hi.
You actually brought a paper copy of the Hartford Current, which
That's
I love
right.
to see
Old
right
school.
In front of us. Old school. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Well, with this august group of reporters in-house, we should really be talking about what's going on with the state legislative session and the budget. Of course, we're sort of running to the end of time here as far as this legislative session, and they're trying to figure out how to plan for the next big budget, how to plan for a current budget deficit. Let me start there, Keith. Once again, we've got to fill up a hole for this year right now. So as we talk about planning, we talk about forward-facing deficits, we talk about, you know, Governor Molloy teaming up with Republicans and everything. Let's just put that aside for a second and say, where are we right now as far as our current budget deficit?
Well, this is the first time since the last recession. It is conceded across the board, we will finish in deficit for the third year in a row. We're going to have to tap the rainy day fund. The fact that the governor put out a plan and the Senate adopted a plan that concedes a deficit. When you're drawing off your rainy day fund to close part of the hole, you've finished already in the red for the third year in a row, not to mention. That, to me, is very telling. It's ironic, too, that ever since, you know, the governor said on the campaign trail, there's not really going to be a deficit. We've ironically had nothing but three deficits. It might be Connecticut's new curse of the Bambino.
But he told me we couldn't have a deficit. Like it's actually not possible. Like that would be fake news or something.
No, it's possible.
It's possible
and it's here.
So I mean, what does this mean up at the state capitol, Daniela? Because right now we're thinking about Democrats and Republicans trying to figure out how to solve long-term structural problems, all that stuff coming down the pike, but we still have to clean up the mess that we're in right now.
Yeah, I mean, there are many messes, and they've all got to be dealt with. You know, there are shortfalls within individual departments due to things like, you know, the medical examiner, chief medical examiner's office. You know, more people dying of opioids means more autopsies, means they're strapped. You know, there are other individual departments that are also strapped, so they've got to deal with that. Then they've got to deal with this year's deficit. Then they've got to deal with, you know, the big problems looming down the road over the next 2 years and beyond. So plenty of problems to go around.
And I will just say that little bit of level of detail is so gruesome. The idea that amongst the many things we have to deal with is an opioid epidemic that means we maybe don't have enough people doing enough autopsies.
Yeah, which is really sad when you think about it.
Which is
yeah.
incredibly sad and, again, something maybe to wonder about. So what does all this mean? I mean, as you're down at the Capitol every day, Max, in terms of the mood down there and how people are cooperating or not on solving these problems?
I think we're at almost a tipping point as far as where the scheduling of all this, because they're supposed to end on June 7th, though it's pretty obvious that they're not going to have a real budget by then. But what's interesting is that we're hearing a lot of optimism still coming from House Democrats. They still seem to think in this, it sounds like almost a kumbaya message with, yeah, we can keep working with Republicans. Joy Arasimowitz, the Speaker of the House, even said yesterday, if the Senate passes a deficit mitigation bill, which they did, we're going to pass it down in the House. That kind of sounds like flowers and rainbows, just considering how the House has worked itself out and the way the Democratic caucus specifically has been fractured. It's been divided, especially on spending matters. Maybe this deficit mitigation package will be okay only because it doesn't quite hit agencies the way a real budget cut would. But I mean, we're kind of splitting hairs as to how bad it really
but
is.
But what do those fractures look like, the fractures within the Democratic Party? I mean, how does that play out?
So there are a number of Democrats that are looking at the landscape in 2018 that are saying to themselves, what votes can I avoid? What votes can I make that are going to protect me? And then you have some other Democrats that are maybe from the cities, maybe the more urban areas. And by the way, this isn't just, you know, white or black. It kind of goes across the spectrum here. And they're looking and saying, well, maybe we should be doing some of those more liberal progressive things. And why isn't my leadership doing that? So it's not quite, I don't think, conservative Democrat or liberal Democrat. I think that maybe we're seeing a kind of change in the way the thinking is going politically.
I think Max is right. There's a real divide in the Democratic caucus. I mean, there are still people that want to see more revenue options on the table. You know, there's still a drumbeat over there, you know, tax the very wealthy, increase the income tax on the very wealthy. There are people that want to see legalized marijuana, you know, from the left and a few from the right as well, from a libertarian point of view.
And even today, there's going to be another press conference on paid family leave. In the middle of this budget crisis, people are still seriously talking about paid family leave. Whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, that's different kind of merits, but it is something that would cost money.
And I think, you know, the leaders at least have shown, you know, they're not going to go down that road. They've said that many times. The Speaker and others on the Finance Committee, Representative Rojas, they are not interested in more taxes on the wealthy. They said they've tried that and it hasn't really worked. They've tried it a couple of times. So,
okay, so then where are we headed, Keith?
I mean, well, I guess all it takes is political will, and you don't have a budget problem if you just say, I refuse to go down that road. I hear what Danielle is saying. I'm just saying too many times the numbers say, welcome to the land of you don't have a choice. I think it's too soon to say it's not going to happen, especially if the concession deal doesn't go forward, because people can say, you know, we're not going to have a deficit, and we certainly have one right now.
Oh, where are we with that concession deal?
Well, the proposal is pending before the unions. I mean, there was some initial talk about a vote in mid-June. I don't think that was ever realistic. The unions have basically made it clear, if you want to give us even an outside chance of selling this, you're talking about a vote in July. You've got to give us plenty of weeks to work the rank and file. And I think nobody wants to rush it. The real question right now is who's on board and who's not. The governor's ready to take the money. And let's be clear what the question is. It is not, is this the best we can get? If it were that simple, it'd be fine. What you're weighing is the savings this is going to give you now. Is it worth the savings you're not going to be able to get, the much larger savings over the next 10 or 20 years, if you let this deal expire in 2022 and you go Wisconsin on our labor laws, to coin a phrase, then all of a sudden you could have a lot more. There are plenty of business lobbyists today who are complaining, going, if only we hadn't done the concession deal in 2011, if only if we had lived without that, we'd have the flexibility right now in 2017 to be saying things like, new state employees don't get a pension and retirement health care. They just get a 401k with no match. That's the trade-off. And I think the real question is going to be, what do the Republicans do? I think Representative Claritas has made it really clear. You may desperately need the money now, but don't kid yourself. You're giving up the potential for greater savings over the next 10 or 20 years because you don't think you'll make it through the next two without these concessions.
And Keith's right. It's not just business leaders who are saying that. It's Republicans as well. You know, do we want to lock ourselves in for 10 years, make this deal? But, you know, to hear some of the rank and file union members who, you know, we've talked to, there's still this idea, why us? Why do we have to give this up? Why aren't we going the route that some of the liberals in the legislature want to go? Why aren't we raising taxes?
And that's what we're hearing from a lot of those different bargaining units. They're all saying, well, why don't we tax the rich? And also, to Keith's point, to Danielle's point, Republicans see blood in the water here politically. They really do. And what they really don't want is to have control of maybe a chamber of the General Assembly next year, possibly even the governor's office. It's 2018. Then you move forward to 2022. Obviously, you have a legislative election in between that. but you may have a Republican governor, and that Republican governor could do nothing to change this union agreement. And that's a politically tenuous position that they're all looking at right now.
Actually, it goes beyond that. The unions made it very clear. All these concessions come if you add 5 years, not four, mm-hmm. not three. The reason is, if you do the math, the current deal expires in 2022. Another way to say that is year four of the next term. And another way to say that is, in 6 months, it's the issue every gubernatorial candidate is going to have a microphone in their face and forced to ask, answer about. If you put it to 2027, that's year one of the third term after Governor Malloy. Or another way to say that is, you could survive 8 years of a Republican governor, and nobody could touch that concessions package, I mean the benefits package, and it would still be in play in 2027.
So one thing, and
It takes it out of the entire election cycle, John.
I've asked you some version of this question a couple times over the years, Keith, and it really gets down to this. So we're talking about a concessions package, which may or may not be a good short or long-term plan for the state. It may or may not be able to get done or ratified by the rank and file, all that stuff. More importantly, let's say that happens. Does it matter? I mean, do the numbers work anyway? Aren't we going to have to raise some taxes somewhere? How exactly do we do this? Even if we zero in right. on this concessions deal, we're still talking about a structural hole that isn't getting any better.
No, it's we are literally, with this deal, saying we're still going to dump costs on our children, but we're not going to dump them in as large a quantity every year. That's what this concession deal does right now. We only set aside about a quarter of the money that we're supposed to for the retirement health care we benefit. We promise today's workers. The rest, every year, we say, see our kids about that when you retire. This is going to increase the amount we set aside, but we're still not going to set aside the full amount. We're still going to be promising a benefit we don't save for, and increasing that long-term liability, which goes to your point. This is not going to stop taxes. This is going to slow the rate of growth of the eventual tax bill we have to face. That is why some people, like the chief one is Representative Claritas, Themis Claritas, is saying, I can't go on board with this deal. The best I can do is say, okay, I'm not going to be dumping costs on my kids as fast as I used to.
So, okay, so what role do the Republicans play in all this, Danielle? I mean, we were talking about splits within the Democratic Party. Max already said, I mean, it's a little hard for Republicans to want to own any of this stuff. But this bad stuff isn't really going to be out of play in the next 2 years or the next 4 years, honestly, anyway. Where does the Republican leadership, especially with this newly constituted Senate, where do they fall in all of this?
Well, Senator Fasano, the leader in the Republican leader in the Senate, has played it pretty close to the vest. I think, Keith, you may know more, but I believe he has not gone on record. He's waiting for the actuaries to sort of score this and figure out, you know, how it plays out. So he hasn't really taken a firm position yet. Themis Claridis, the Republican leader in the House of Representatives, has been more upfront and expressed some serious reservations, as Keith just laid out. You know, she potentially could be a candidate for governor in 2018. She also potentially could be the Speaker of the House in 2018, should the Republicans gain control of the chamber. So
I think it's hard to see exactly where this ends, but I think this kind of looks almost like a ballet that Republicans are doing to try to – we were all going on the assumption early on in this legislative session that Republicans had zero interest at all in putting their fingerprints on a budget. What I don't know the answer to is whether this budget situation has gotten so bad that they now have to put their fingerprints on it. Senator Fasano, I think you're right, Danielle, has not said either way whether he supports it. He's waiting to hear back. But voting for a deficit mitigation package is completely different than allowing a benefit concessions deal to go through. It's completely different politically, because then you could very easily say to Len Fasano and every other Republican, you guys did this as much as the Democrats.
Yeah, I'll just say very quickly, boys and girls, read your Danielle Altomare, because she nailed it. Len Fasano has definitely left the door open in case he says, look, we could save more later, but we just aren't going to make it through the next 2 years without this money. I think he's the real question. If he goes over to the let's take the concessions crowd, then Representative Claritas stands alone, and you have to wonder how much longer the House Republicans are at the budget bargaining table. If he stays with her, maybe the summer drags into the fall.
But I think it might be politically advantageous for the Republicans to just stay on the sideline because they don't own any of it. Maybe that's mine.
I want to, before we take a break, there's so much other stuff that always is supposed to happen or might happen at the state capitol. Some of these things actually have something to do with the budget. They've got some sort of a fiscal note attached. Many of them don't. Let's just go through some of these things. Quickly, Daniela, there was a bill that would change how nuclear energy is sold in Connecticut. It hasn't passed either chamber. What do we know about this? This is the so-called Millstone bailout bill. People who work with Millstone hate it when we say that, but I'm just going to say it because that's how a lot of people are referring to it.
Yeah, and I was talking with a lawmaker on the Energy Committee yesterday, and they're hopeful. I mean, everybody's hopeful that their bill is going to get through this logjam. But, you know, as of today, with 1 week to go in the legislative session, it's not looking good for a lot of important legislation. I mean, there are advocates out there who want to see an end to solitary confinement in Connecticut. That's hung up in the chambers. I mean, there's a lot of important stuff that has not gotten done.
Anything else hung up that we've been talking about, Keith, that maybe isn't going to get done because this last this rush at the end?
I mean, a lot of the things tied to the budget will be in play until the budget implementation language is done. So you can't really close the door on pot or casinos or anything until that's resolved. By the way, if you hear, we're running a bill on tolls, we're doing this on tolls, I still think the bottom line is the chances of tolls being enacted, anything more than a study this year, are so incredibly slim just because of the political fear right now. It doesn't matter what we need. The money, you can't get the money for several years.
Okay, you can't get the money for several years, but we are talking about a problem, Max, that goes out several years. So if we talk about casinos, people can argue whether or not casinos is the right way to raise money, but we need money. If you want to talk about pot, people can argue about whether or not now is the time to implement legalized marijuana in the state, but we need money. And same with tolls. People might not like tolls. It might not be the right time for tolls, but we need money. In the past, the state, both Republicans and Democrats, mostly Democrats because they have been in control of things for such a long time, they have said, like, if we need money for stuff, Keno, we'll actually pass some things and hold our noses and put them forward. Is there any chance that we see any of these things with a little fiscal note attached coming to the fore at the very end because we got to make the budget balance?
The way you talk in footnotes like that is unbelievable, John, by the way, those little asides. It's very impressive. But I think all that's possible. I think that that those of us who have been covering the building this year especially, everyone's been talking, it's all going to be about the budget implementation language, just like what Keith said. For the average Joe taxpayer, that is the single worst thing you can hear. We're not going to get that budget implement. And all that is, by the way, folks, is the law that says this is how we're going to pay for all this stuff. This is how we're going to enact all this stuff. There's no sunlight on it. There's no committee hearing process on it. So we will find out at the last minute whether those things like marijuana and tolls are in there. On a topic like marijuana specifically, people have stopped talking about, well, this is the right thing to do. It's about the thing that the region is doing. We should stay up with the times socially and politically. No. This is about money. That's all this is about. And I think that for that reason, you very well might see that in there.
Well, I wonder about that. I mean, things that are as controversial as some of the topics we just raised, Daniel, I mean, a lot of stuff gets crammed into these implementers at the end. Do we really realistically see any of these big ticket items coming in at the very last moment?
I can't predict. Who knows? I mean, you know, it's to some degree just the kitchen sink at the very end. It's very hard to handicap any of this stuff. You know, the idea of legalized marijuana, that has had several public hearings, I believe. There are real questions about, you know, some of the amount of money that you know, proponents are thinking they're going to generate from this. There were wildly inflated figures, I think. They're anticipating much more money than, for instance, Colorado, a much bigger state, which was the only one out there with legal marijuana brought in its first year. So, you know, some of it is just, you know, rainbows and unicorns and wishful thinking, and I just don't know how much it adds up.
And just going back to your point, John, about our taxes really off the table. Just to remind people right now, just in the governor's budget, you have over $800 million in different tax proposals. They're spread out so finely between income tax credits worth $160 million. People are already forgetting we have income tax increases proposed. Cigarette, real estate conveyance, a $200 million property tax increase on hospitals at the local level that's out there. And the last Democratic budget talked about taking $200 million away in municipal aid from some to be identified down the road grant. They didn't include town-by-town runs. Where I'm going with this is nobody even wants the rank-and-file legislators to look at what a, I won't say tax hike-free budget, but a scattered tax hike budget looks like, because they'll see, oh, my God, aid to almost every community not named Hartford is gutted. When people see that, I think the budget debate starts all over again and said, oh, I didn't realize it was going to cut the aid to my town.
Well, and I have to ask you, Daniela, before the break, I mean, this does come up. I mean, we've been hearing this from towns and cities for years, this complaint about whether or not they're going to get from the state what they expect to get from the state. There's the worry about property taxes and how much they're going to have to shoulder themselves. I mean, how's that playing out at the Capitol? Because I think it can only go so far.
Well, we heard some strong words yesterday from the House Speaker who said, basically, you know, towns, stop. You guys are whining and complaining to us every year, looking to us, you know, to fill whatever gaps you have in the budget. You know, we've made some changes, and yet, you know, you guys are giving your superintendents 3% raises. You're giving your town managers raises. You're, you know, doing all this stuff. You're not regionalizing. So really, stop looking at us. Now, obviously, the towns are saying, wait a minute, you know, we've done a lot of things that you guys haven't done. So, you know, it was a little bit of a game of finger pointing. But, you know, we heard some pretty strong words yesterday from the House Speaker saying, you know, cities and towns, stop your whining.
I just have to say, though, I mean, regionalism, something we've talked about on this program and where we live for years and years and years, may be a really good idea. We just we just read something from Gary Laveau talking once again about maybe we go to counties.
Yeah.
Well, we can go to counties, Max, but the fact is, I mean, the legislature would have to pass new taxing authority for counties to be able to raise money on their own. I mean, that would have to go through the legislature, too.
I'm only going to challenge you on this point, John. Whenever people talk about regionalism and the word county comes up, that is the most Connecticut historical answer to everything. What's our answer with government? Well, let's create a new level of government. That's the most Connecticut answer.
It's worked so well so far.
We've done it for so long. You don't need to do that. That's just not what's needed. Whenever you hear Republicans or Democrats talk about structural change, they don't know what they're talking about. Structural change in Connecticut would make Connecticut look like, I don't know, the other 48 states in America that have larger school systems with fewer administration, larger police departments with fewer chiefs and lieutenants. That's what a lot of the rest of America looks like. Whenever I talk with other business people who come into the state from out of the state, they say Connecticut is not a state, it's a metro area. We're 90 miles north to south, about 110 east to west. Yet we have 169 cities and towns with moats around them and with gators in those moats. And you can't touch each other. And whenever I hear structural change, my head begins to hurt a little bit because no one's actually saying what it is. And those things that I just said, everyone goes, absolutely not. That's not the way we do things. And then we continue spending the same amount of money we spent.
Last point, Keith.
The gators Max are talking about, the reason all this is going on is because Connecticut owes billions of dollars that will not get you anything. You're raising taxes or you're cutting local aid. Fine. What do I get for it? Here's what you get. We pay the money that should have been paid into the pension fund 30 years ago. That's all we're doing. We're paying 1985's bills. It is very hard to sell a tax increase, a social service program cut, a municipal aid cut when you say, well, what are you doing? We're bringing credibility to your parents' and grandparents' budget. That's not a good bumper sticker, but that's the truth. And nobody wants to have that discussion because it is impossible politically to sell, but legally, the bill's coming.
Mm. Those gators, by the way, Max, weren't here a couple of years ago. Climate change, you know, they come north from Florida like everything else. We're joined by Max Reese, who reports on politics for NBC Connecticut. Keith Faniff, the budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror. Daniela Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. When we come back, we're going to talk about, well, insurance and health care, whether or not Aetna is going to stay here in the state and what the head of Aetna is saying about a single payer system. We'll be right back in the wheelhouse after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Daniela Altamari, State House reporter for the Hartford Current, Keith Vanniff, budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror, and Max Reese, who's a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Colin McEnroe is off this week, enjoying a nice week of rest, and we'll have him back again next week. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We ended that first segment with some of the bills that are being considered at the state capitol, among them a bipartisan effort to change what pharmacists can tell their patients about drug prices. It unanimously passed the Senate, awaiting action in the House. Following passage in the Senate, Governor Malloy sent a letter to Martin Looney, who's the Senate president, Senate Republican leader, Len Fasano, chastising them for being unnecessarily antagonistic to the insurance industry, which employs some 60,000 state residents. Let's listen to the governor.
When an industry which employs over 60,000 people in our state, directly and indirectly many, many more, comes to the table and wants to work with the legislature to format legislation that will do exactly what they want to do, it would be appropriate to bring the experts in and listen to them.
So this is interesting, Keith, this idea of, I don't know, letting people know about their drug prices is something that the governor's maybe saying is antagonistic toward the insurance industry. We're going to talk a little bit about the insurance industry staying in Connecticut here. What do we know about this? This is kind of an interesting fight because obviously Governor Malloy is trying to keep those 60,000 jobs.
I think there's also some concern about what's going to happen with our health exchange. I mean, think about this. If there is too much of a, to use the governor's, or to go to his phrase, an antagonistic attitude, we're already concerned that the exchange may not have participants. The whole thing could collapse. People are worried about Aetna. I think they just sort of see some critical mass building here. And if I can, I was curious. I wanted to ask Daniela, because I know that the Current did something on this today, if they think that both Mayor Bronin and Governor Malloy see an opportunity here to perhaps get people to move on, like bankruptcy for Hartford or on the state budget, because they can hold this, what's happening with the insurance industry as a whole, up as a crisis and say, look, this is why we've got to do these other things for Connecticut.
Mm. Daniela?
Could be. I mean, this is certainly what we're talking about is a report by Kevin Rennie initially that Aetna is close to decamping to Manhattan. And obviously there's been a lot of talk in recent weeks about Aetna and what their future holds and where they will or won't end up. And, you know, after what happened with General Electric leaving the state and the sort of psychological damage that brought to Connecticut, losing Aetna in some ways would be, you know, far more significant and far more painful, at least for the Hartford region. So, you know, we'll see. I mean,
here's in part what Kevin Rennie, who writes a column for the Hartford Current, wrote on his blog, Daily Ructions. He says, New York is far ahead of Boston in competition for Hartford-based Aetna's new headquarters. After 164 years in Hartford, the insurance giant invited proposals from Boston and New York. The city that never sleeps is soon expected to win a public acknowledgement of its victory, writes Kevin. Another obstacle for Hartford has been dynamic Aetna CEO's, dynamic is Kevin's word, Aetna CEO's Mark Bertolini's famously frosty relationship with surly Connecticut Governor Daniel P. Malloy. Surly is also Kevin's word. Senator Richard Blumenthal's opposition to Aetna's merger with Humana confirmed Connecticut's top political leadership's hostility to a company trying to grow in an industry facing urgent challenges in and out of the marketplace. So we hear the governor saying that legislative leaders are being too antagonistic toward the health industry. Kevin Rennie saying, well, the governor doesn't have the best relationship with Aetna and Mark Bertolini. There is, of course, a question about how much political leaders might need to bend over backwards for an insurance giant that has held up both President Obama and the state hostage, it seems, over a health care exchange and over their place here in the state.
A couple of points in all this. Governor Malloy had another line last week that was the good soundbite. He said, why do we keep kicking one of our most important employment sectors in the shins? Why do we keep doing that? Not to say that's an about face, but people just don't characterize Governor Dan Malloy as being the most business-friendly governor. He just doesn't have that characterization. Second of all, we've all spoken with multiple sources, I know I have, that say that Governor Dan Malloy and Mark Bertolini just don't like each other. And what I've heard from a couple, from more than one person, is that it comes down to personal issues between the two, that Mark Bertolini doesn't like the tax increases that have hit his pocketbook in recent years. But what I also learned last week was that that, remember, Mark Bertolini is he's a political, he knows politics. He knows how these things work. He doesn't want to be seen as a follower of Jeff Immelt and General Electric. He wants Aetna to kind of have its own destiny, which is why New York would make a lot more sense than just following and going to Boston. My own hypothesis, this is what my own gut was, when the Aetna and Travelers and the Hartford announced end of last year that they were going to help, they're going to, or maybe it was beginning of this year, it was December or January, that they were going to help with $10 million annually for 5 years, over the next 5 years to the city of Hartford. To me, that always sounded like a really good olive branch setting up something really disappointing. Is kind of what it always sounded like, just given the political climate and the economic climate.
I will say our frequent colleague here, Dan Haar, who writes a column for the Hartford Courant, got into a little battle back and forth with Shirley Leung, a columnist at the Boston Globe. She's basically saying, Daniela, Aetna should come to Boston. It's a perfect place for them. Danny's like, no, it's not a very – and so we got a little war with Boston, although from what Kevin Rennie's writing, it doesn't seem as though Boston's the first choice.
Yeah, it would seem from this latest report that New York is the first choice. Danny's column, which was, I think, ran in Saturday's paper, is everyone should check it out and read it. It's great.
So, Keith, once again, I wanted to avoid beating my head against the microphone because it sounds really bad if you're in the car. But so what Max just laid out is that it possibly we have an issue of personality between Mark Bertolini and Daniel Malloy, which may or may not have anything to do with anything. But it is probably informing some decisions that the individuals are making. Then there's another problem that Connecticut seems to be facing, which is we're concerned about the employment sector, quite rightly. A whole bunch of people work in the insurance industry. And we're concerned about, as Daniela said, psychology. We don't want to lose another big corporate headquarters. But then we're conflating this with making state policy about, you know, how we regulate, say, the insurance industry, how we actually view insurance and try to get costs down for everyone. It feels to me, I don't even know if I'm going to ask you a question now, Keith. It feels to me as though we're not exactly looking at this in a way that makes the most possible sense for the people of Connecticut who need to have health insurance options. And we also need to have jobs for them.
No, this is the latest example of where Keith brings everything back to the budget.
I was hoping you'd do okay, that. So why didn't even have to ask you a question?
No, you don't even have to beat your head. whether it's Aetna, whether it's GE, the companies that ultimately either leave Connecticut or look to leave Connecticut do their own research. And they say, hey, I wonder why I was promised a tax cut and I got a tax hike. Or why do I read about these deficits? Or why whatever I don't like is happening? And inevitably they see, oh my God, do you know how much money Connecticut owes over the next 15 years? They're up the creek and there's no paddle in sight. That's basically the type of conversation that happens. So at some point, Connecticut actually has to call out that problem publicly and try to deal with it. And I don't just mean deal with it with like austerity that barely survives one biennial cycle, and then you have to go through 7 or 8 more two-year cycles, exponentially worse. They have to actually have a plan. Now we have to get into the T word, you know, with taxes, over the next 15 years and say, how are we going to pay what we owe and still make decent investments to make this state amenable to Aetna and GE and the like? How can you do that if you're still hoping the public won't notice this growing problem? It's like literally you've got garbage stinking up your house and you're saying, well, maybe if I just don't mention it until company leaves, they won't smell the rotting smell in the next room. That's what's going on. And right now, people are trying to see, is there any way we can solve this problem without telling the voters how much money generations past, legislatures past, governors past put us on the hook for? Because if they see that bill, they're going to want to shoot some messengers.
Max?
To your point a moment ago,
it was more of a rant. Actually,
it was a rant. But it entangles a lot of things. People want health care options, and people want cheaper health care.
Yes,
right. Senator Richard Blumenthal was arguing on behalf of the state of Connecticut and on behalf of others as a member of the U.S. Senate that the Aetna-Humana merger was bad for Connecticut and bad for consumers. Okay, that directly hurts Connecticut because Aetna is right here in Connecticut. It's very easy to draw the line and say, you did this, Senator Blumenthal. Not to conflate issues too much, but this is also the same Senator Blumenthal who sued the ACC, saying that other teams can't leave, and now UConn is a team without a conference, essentially, in the American Athletic Conference. And there are financial things that went along with that. All of these issues are conflated, and I'm not sure there's a way to get out of this image mess and this climate mess here.
Well, let's actually turn to something else that Mark Bertolini was saying recently. The chief executive told employees in a private meeting earlier this month he thinks that the United States should at least have a debate about single-payer health care. Let's listen for a second.
Single-payer. I think we should have that debate as a nation. But let me remind everybody that Aetna was the first financial intermediary for Medicare. We cut the first check for Medicare in 1965 to Hartford Hospital for $517.57. So the government doesn't administer anything. The first thing they've ever tried to administer in social programs was the ACA, and that didn't go so well. So the industry has always been the back room for government, and if the government wants to pay all the bills and employers want to stop offering coverage and we can be there in a public-private partnership to do the work we do today with Medicare and with Medicaid at every state level. We run the Medicaid programs for them. Then let's have that conversation. But if we want to turn it all over to the government to run, is the government really the right place to run all this stuff? And that's the debate that needs to be had. They can finance it, and if there's one financer, you could call that single payer.
Okay, so that's Mark Bertolini. At least thinking about the idea out loud about a single-payer healthcare system, something that, of course, got taken off the table now several years ago, in part by another former U.S. Senator, Joe Lieberman. But I guess I'm wondering, Keith, about this idea. I mean, if you have Mark Bertolini talking openly about this, we're going to talk for a moment in a second about Kevin Lembo, who's running for governor, maybe thinking about a Connecticut single-payer option of some sort. And is this a conversation that is starting to be had even up at the state capitol once again? Because, you know, people are thinking about a new vision for healthcare. We just saw this Kaiser Health poll come out today. People don't love the ACA, but they really, really don't love the new Republicans plan. I mean, I don't know. Is this the time to be talking about this at least?
I think you can have the conversation at the national level. You know, with all due respect to the comptroller, I don't think Connecticut is even close to in any type of a position where they could move into some type of a single-payer system. They actually had a fiscal note put together almost, I think, for kicks in the very early 2000s for Don Williams, for then the Senate President Pro Tem. And everyone was like, single-payer would cost what? Okay, we're done. That's not something realistic at the state level.
I misspoke. And he's really talking about a public option at the state level, something that has been floated by our colleague Bill Curry over the course of time. But again, an option to what we have currently.
This is happening at the same time every single caucus and Governor Malloy are looking at moving thousands of working poor adults off of Husky. We're moving in the other direction. I mean, you can talk about the debate, but it's not happening in Connecticut.
I think when you talk to regular people on the street, if you were to discuss this on the national level, if you say to them, you're never going to see another bill for health care, right? You're never going to see another bill for that MRI, that X-ray, that knee exam, or that mammogram for that matter, people would take that deal if that means a little more taxes out of their pocket to pay for it. The problem is I think it's a very hard sell because I think you need to explain a lot of it. I mean, also, the optics of this got fascinating when President Trump praised the Prime Minister of Australia, their healthcare system, saying they have such a better healthcare. They've had a single payer system there for decades.
Well, and I don't know, Danielle, it's something that's maybe not going to be talked about anytime soon at the state capitol as far as some sort of a public option. Kevin Lembo trying to raise this issue. But it is, I guess, fascinating, Mark Bertolini raising this at the national or the federal level. It's a part of the debate that we had for a moment during the 2016 election because Bernie Sanders was beating that drum and millions of people came out to vote for Bernie Sanders. It's just interesting that the head of Aetna, as he's talking about so many other things, including maybe moving out of Connecticut, is talking about single payer once again.
Yeah, and you're right. Bernie Sanders talked about it and millions of people voted for him, but he didn't win. So
yes, You are right about that. Danielle Altamari, State House reporter for the Hartford Courant. Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Our budget guru at the Connecticut Mirror, Keith Faniff, is here as well. When we come back, we're going to talk about a story that the Hartford Courant and others have been following about crumbling foundations in the quiet corner. We'll also take some of your phone calls, 860-275-7266. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Keith Faniff. He covers the budget for the Connecticut Mirror. Danielle Altamari, State House reporter for the Hartford Courant. Max Reese, who covers politics for NBC Connecticut. Before we turn to the story about crumbling foundations in the quiet corner, I just want to quickly mention, Max, we talked about Kevin Lembo in the last segment. You know, he put out an idea about maybe an insurance public option, something that's been talked about for years. He's one of these interesting characters. He's the state comptroller, and he's showing up in the political sphere because he's obviously making at least noise about running for governor. How much is the race for governor influencing some of what's happening at the state capitol right now?
I think the point that Daniela made earlier about Themis Claridis, I think that we don't know whether she's going to run for governor yet, but I think what's clear is that she's making political calculations on every soundbite she makes and things like that. Obviously, Governor Dan Malloy feels unshackled. But what's interesting is that we're beginning to get those press releases from time to time from your Mark Boutons, from your Peter Lumages, and from other Republicans saying, well, they just did this, and if I'm governor, I would do this. Chris Maddie, another one, a Democrat, has put out more. I think that everyone kind of sees that there's a talking point, there's a reaction to every single thing that's going on. And to be perfectly frank, though, to answer your question more finitely, definitely is actually the better word there. Definitely is actually the finitely, but I'll be over here anyway. Sorry. I think that so much conversation is just composed of the budget right now that it's hard for any of those gubernatorial candidates to really make any noise.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would read every move that Representative Claridis makes as sort of a political calculation. I think she's been pretty ideologically consistent, and I don't think she's doing anything that's – I mean, I don't know, you know, what her thinking is. I don't know what her – we don't know what her plans are for the future. But I think, you know, she's really doing what she believes is right, whether, you know, whatever the political calculation is down the road. She's been pretty consistent on all of this tax and spending stuff.
Keith? Yeah, I see the dynamic you're talking about, John. I just think it goes in reverse. What's happening at the Capitol is influencing mm-hmm. the gubernatorial contenders.
Mm-hmm. That's the way you put
Kevin
it.
Lembo put out one of – Max was referring to different emails they put out. One of Kevin's came out shortly after the concessions deal saying, hey, remember everyone, I voted against the millions of dollars of public assistance for some of the wealthiest mm-hmm. hedge funds, most powerful hedge funds in the state, which has always been a thorn in the side of the unions. They really are still holding a grudge over the fact that we're not taxing the wealthy and we're doling out public dollars to Bridgewater and another major hedge fund. That's how I see it flowing.
Mm. A quick phone call from Mike in Manchester. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Today?
I'm good. What's on your mind, Mike?
Well, I'm 63 years old, and I've lived in Connecticut my entire life. And I just watched this budget problem go as far back as I can remember as El Grasso. And it's a lot of hypocrisy to go around. But we've got to the point right now, there's two fundamental ways to fix this. We either have the political will to have a Scott Walker moment. We drag everybody to the table and go, the haircut's going to be real fine, and it's going to be real short. Or we just declare bankruptcy and rewrite these contracts because we kick this down the road up to 10 years, it'll be done for us. It's that simple.
Mike, thanks very much. Keith?
Sorry, you can't declare bankruptcy. And I don't even think for those who say, well, I mean, let's go to court. The wealthiest state and the wealthiest nation in the world is going to go to a federal judge and say, Your Honor, we wouldn't be the wealthiest state if we actually honor our obligations. I think the judge is going to say, no one ever promised you. You were always going to be more affluent than Michigan. Get back to me when you're Arkansas, but in the meantime, pay your bills.
Oh,
get back to me when you're Arkansas. Let's turn for the end of our program to an interesting series of pieces in the Hartford Current, editorials about crumbling foundations in the quiet corner of the state. More than 500 people from the Current have filed complaints with the State Department of Consumer Protection. A true number is widely believed to be much larger, anywhere from 5,000 to 34,000, depending on who you talk to. And this is about foundations in their homes, Daniela, that are essentially crumbling. This is reporting we've been seeing for some time, but the Current has been writing big opinion pieces about this.
Yeah, and credit where credit's due. Max's former colleague, George Colley, actually was way out in front of this story on NBC Connecticut. He was onto it in the very early stages. It's a tragedy. I mean, these folks, you really feel for them, and you really feel like this is a place where government needs to help. I mean, there was one guy quoted in one of the editorials who said, if a tornado came through and did, ruin my home, I'd, have insurance and it would be covered. And, yet this type of disaster just is devastating. And they're basically left out there trying to figure this out on their own.
Well, and the question, Max, is who's responsible for this disaster?
And that's the problem. The questions abound. I mean, over at NBC Connecticut, we've talked to FEMA. We've done a lot of reporting that the Current's done. And when you talk to FEMA, especially, that you kind of look to them because they have this giant pot of money. And at FEMA, they're pretty clear where they say this really isn't our problem. They say we deal with disasters when they happen, not ones that take 20 years to happen. And when I spoke with one guy at FEMA, he said to me, Max, even if we had 100,000 homes that would happen, that doesn't quite reach what, to Danielle's point, about a tornado or an earthquake or a tsunami or something. It just doesn't reach that point. I know that Joe Courtney has talked about trying to get some more money from, I think, the SBA, the Small Business Administration, other different loan programs, but I cannot imagine what these homeowners are feeling with all this.
And it affects tens of thousands of people potentially, Keith. So there's some real money at stake here. And, many people, as we read these Current articles, are saying out loud, this could be a problem for everything from insurers to banks, obviously individuals having big problems. So it just seems to add to this sort of list of miserables that the state is dealing with.
Right. To me, the key word right now is certainty. This is the reason everybody has anxiety. The homeowners understandably are saying, look, will someone just assure me that the federal government, the state government, somebody's going to step up? The state of Connecticut, like Max said, it's kind of already seeing the writing on the wall that they're not ruling out the federal government, but they haven't seen a lot of promise yet. But the state also isn't sure if they start pulling on this string, when it's going to stop. How many homeowners ultimately 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now will be identified. So before they commit to do something for someone, they have to get an idea, some certainty about the extent of the problem. So what they're really, all they can do right now is promise to amass evidence. And that doesn't provide any certainty or relief to the homeowners.
Yeah, it doesn't provide any of these things, Daniel, that obviously people are looking for. So what exactly happens next? I mean, as we shine a light on a big problem, it would be discouraging as a homeowner to have the state, the federal government, all just, shrugging your shoulders and saying, there's only so much we can do.
Mm-hmm. It would seem like there might be, this might be a case where you're just, appoint one person to sort of be the point person on all this and just, sort of, because right now, as Max laid out, the federal government and, the congressional delegation, and state lawmakers and the governor's office and everybody sort of just kind of looking for answers. But maybe there's a way to sort of streamline the process and at least, help people pull all the threads together.
So it's some sort of a foundation's czar appointed, mm-hmm. Look at this.
I also think what's so tragic about this, which was laid out very well, I think it was in part three, part three of the editorial series, is that there was knowledge of this in 2002. Mm-hmm. This wasn't something that just popped up in 2014. This started, obviously it started in the 1980s, but it started in 2002. And the shame of this is, I think, where in a lot of ways in politics and in government, people stay in their lane and stay in their bubble and won't necessarily listen to that, frankly, regular person who lives in Tolland or they live in another part of the quiet corner. And they're saying, look, I'm really having a problem here. And other homeowners just like me having this problem, too. And government really turned a blind eye to it. So if I'm somebody in Connecticut, I would have some pessimism, too, about what government can do to help out.
Well, pessimism, it seems, is the thing we have in great abundance here in the Constitution State today. It was a fairly pessimistic conversation, but a fun conversation with Max Reese, politics reporter for NBC Connecticut. Thanks so much, Max.
Always good to be here, John.
Keith Vanoff, our budget guru, our budget Obi-Wan Kenobi from the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks for, I don't know, keeping it light and cheery, Keith, as always.
Have a beautiful day, Connecticut.
Danielle Altamari, State House reporter for the Hartford Courant. Thank you so much, Daniela.
Thank you.
And lots of good stuff to read in the Hartford Courant around the story we were just talking about. If you want to find out more about our show, go to WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Thanks to Heather Brandon, Katie Talarski, our executive producer, and thanks to Betsy Kaplan for running the board today. This is The Wheelhouse.